We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome back to Overnight America. This is an interesting topic. Education here in the United States, as you know, seems to be up for discussion a lot. We always find ways to disagree on how we should handle it. We sometimes compare ourselves to other countries. So how about we talk to someone that's traveled and actually looked at the different systems in place to see maybe the things we can steal from theirs and implement into ours? What are the things we're doing right? What are some of the things that she thinks we may be doing wrong? It's author of the new book called World Class, One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children. Author Taru Clavel, thank you for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you so much for having me, Ryan.
How much traveling did you actually do?
A ton.
Yeah? How much? Yeah, how many countries did you visit?
So we were in Hong Kong, Shanghai, Tokyo, and came back to the U.S. So, you know, I mean, people want to say Hong Kong, China, not quite sure if it's the same country. I would say maybe yes. So We were in three countries.
Yeah. And you visited schools or did you talk to educators? Or what did you do when you were there?
So basically, when I had two kids under 2 years old, we moved to Hong Kong, and I put my kids in the local public schools there, and we were there for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Shanghai for 2 years, and again, put the kids into local public schools. But by that point, I had three kids, boy, boy, girl. And then we moved to Tokyo, and again, public schools, were there for 4 years, and then moved to California for 2 years, and then came literally around the world and came back to New York City.
Wow.
And that was 12 years.
Well, what was the language barrier there? What language did they grow up speaking?
So at home, I always spoke English to them, and in Hong Kong and in Shanghai, they spoke Mandarin, and in Japan, they spoke Japanese. And then they went to school in English for the first time in 2016 in California.
Wow. How in the world were they able to do all, and keep all of that straight, multiple languages in the education systems? That's very impressive.
Well, you know, it's amazing how much kids can do when they don't know any different. They just kind of muscle up and get it done. And, you know, they weren't fully immersive environments where everybody spoke those languages. So it wasn't as if they were really learning them, like you would learn a second or a third language. So it was really more my responsibility to keep up the English at home, which I felt more pressure to do.
Yeah. Did you know the languages, the native languages, when you were living in those different areas?
So that's a good question. So Japanese is actually my first language, though I grew up in the U.S. because mm-hmm. my mom is a first-gen immigrant from Japan. Mm-hmm. But I didn't speak a word of Mandarin. And my kids didn't speak a word of Japanese when we arrived in Tokyo in 2012, even though it's my first language, because we really were focusing on supporting their Mandarin at that point.
Right. So there are some barriers for you as well to get past.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. No question.
Well, that's
big barriers.
Yeah, no kidding. And when we look at the way that they handle education in those different systems, and you've seen it firsthand, what are some of your general impressions of how each of them handle education?
Well, it's, you know, I would say when we first got to Shanghai, it really hits you how much the city, the nation, it completely values education and the next generation over anything else. And when we lived there, there was still a one-child policy, right? And I had three kids, so it was a lot to juggle. But that one child represented the gateway to everybody's future. Mm. And that one child would have two sets of grandparents and a set of parents. So you had, you know, two, four, six adults who were doing anything for that one child's education. I mean, people would mortgage their home, get a second mortgage, sell their car, do whatever it took to invest in that child's education. And to the point where the city would literally almost completely shut down when the college admissions exams would take place.
Wow.
Because everybody knew that was, you know, that was a be-all, end-all test. There's no other application. It's just everything is based on that exam. And you could see the parents and the grandparents would stand at these school gates for days while their kids went and took this exam. And since it was only offered once a year, if you got sick, I mean, there were literally kids who went in there with IVs.
Wow.
Because that was it. So that just, you know, that prioritization, and it wasn't to the extreme that it was in Shanghai, but in Japan too. I mean, there's a reason why in Japan, 6-year-olds are expected to get to and from school and to their activities completely on their own.
At six?
And that could include, it's 6 years old, right?
What?
And that could include not only walking to school, but if you go to a further, you know, a school that's geographically further away, it could require public bus, train, and walking. And it could take over an hour to get there and back. And because there's so much, you know, the kids are taken care of and there's so much community value, 6-year-olds are totally safe.
That is amazing to me. So if you're a parent that drives your kids to school when they're 6 and 7, you're looked at as the oddity?
Well, you're kind of looked at as, well, What did you do wrong in your parenting? Why aren't your kids
why aren't they walking alone to school? Wow.
Yeah. Why aren't they doing it on their own? It's remarkable. The kids have so much independence at that age.
That is really remarkable.
Cool.
All right, so
yeah.
You're the author of World Class, One Mother's Journey, Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children, and author Taru Clavel joining us here on Overnight America. So you've learned a lot in those different school systems. You probably also learned the parental involvement in each of those systems, too.
Yes. So in Shanghai, I should say in both countries, the transparency and the importance of the relationship, that triangulated relationship amongst the parent, the teacher, and the student is priority. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no conflict. There is no blaming. Everybody is on the same page, to the point where in Japan, there's mandatory parent education. And in my daughter's preschool, you actually had to write a letter to opt out of the parent education session.
Huh.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Right? It's crazy. And it got to the point where with my third child, I'm in this preschool in Tokyo, and I'm thinking, yeah, okay, what is a 25-year-old teacher going to teach me? This is my third kid. And within 5 minutes, I would be sitting there writing profuse notes in my notebook because they were telling me so much new information about my child's development and what I should be doing at home to support the school curriculum that's supporting her child development at that exact stage. Wow. So it was remarkable. And as an example, too, based on that transparency between the home, the teacher, and the home and the teacher, you know, I want to ask you, Ryan, guess how long how many pages the report card was in Shanghai?
Oh, man. Well, here in the United States, it's one sheet.
Okay.
In Shanghai? Yeah. I don't know. I'm gonna guess high and say it. No more than 3 pages. That can't be possible.
Okay. 46 pages.
What?
It was a book. Yeah.
40s for each 40, child?
For each child. And when I first got this, I thought, you know, because I went in with all these preconceived notions about, yeah, it's all rote, it's just, you know, memorization and all this other stuff. That's nonsense. So starting in first grade in Shanghai, all classes are taught by subject-specific teachers. So it's kind of like what you may have in high school here, right? So you have in first grade, you have your Chinese teacher, you have your math teacher, science, social studies, and there English starts in first grade. So you have all these teachers, and in the report card book, I mean, it literally is a book, every teacher would write a report not only on the academics, but the second half of every subject area was based on their behaviors, their ambition, their initiative, their contribution, their cooperation, their attitudes. It was remarkable. And here's the kicker. The teacher wrote their comment, and then the parent wrote the comment, and then the student did. So they were literally all on the same page.
Wow. We think about the way education is here and the amount of workload that every teacher is under. They seem like they're overworked. There's a lot of stress. They have a hard time keeping up because they have too many kids in the classroom. And I don't understand how the teachers would even be able to dedicate that much time. How do they do it? Like, are the classrooms a lot smaller between the teacher and student?
No. So that's okay. So I'll give you another example of that, and then I'll answer your question, which is, so in Japan, depending on the grade, let's say in elementary school, there can be 32 or 35 kids per class. And then, you know, if kids come in during the school year, then it could exceed that number. So we're not talking about, you know, 10 or 15 kids per class. And every day in Japan, there's a notebook that's passed between the home and the teacher. And you can, and the parent can write anything. It could be, you know, Jackie didn't feel well or didn't understand an assignment. And the teacher could write the same thing. Jackie had a little argument with somebody, or maybe needs help with this math assignment or whatever it may be. And it literally goes back and forth between the home and the school. And the teacher actually comments every single day for wow. every single student. And so it goes against kind of our thinking of how much time, right, the teacher may have when the teacher has so many students. But something that, you know, hopefully your listeners will learn is that compared to other nations, our teachers spend more hours in the classroom than almost any other country. Meaning most of these teachers spend more time in an office, like a teacher office, collaborating with each other, investing in their time in professional development, right? Lesson planning. Mm-hmm. So we're not really supporting our teachers in this country because they're too busy in the classrooms when they should be, you know, investing in their own professional development and having what's called horizontal alignment, which means they're meeting with teachers that teach the same grade, and vertical alignment, so they know what's coming into their classroom, right? If they're a second grade teacher, they know what was taught in first grade, and then working with third, fourth, and fifth, so they know what they're preparing their kids for.
Yeah. Wow. So, I have so many other questions for you. Do you mind holding on after the break?
No, absolutely.
Let's do that. And she's the author of the book called World Class, One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children. This is so fascinating to me. Taru Clavel, will continue our conversation with her next on KMOX.
Get home fast and informed. Total Information PM starts weekdays at 4 on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX and KMOX.com.
All right, I've learned a lot so far, and we've only spoke for about 10 or 15 minutes. Author of the book called World Class, One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children. Taru Clavel, thank you for sticking around to Overnight America.
It's my pleasure, Ryan.
So I'm looking at some of the different things that you're saying. I was taking some notes, how other countries value the next generation and they invest so much into the next generation. You look at how they treat the teachers and how the teachers treat the kids and the parents treat the teachers. There's a lot of things that I'm hearing right now that seem somewhat foreign to the ideas that we do in our own education system in the United States. So before we get to some of your impressions, I want to know what happened to your kids when they came here to the United States and then they were inside of the U.S.'s education system. Were they, what was the integration like coming to the United States for them?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think there's this preconceived notion that in East Asia, because there's so many more kids in a class for one teacher, that they don't get this individualized attention. But I feel like my kids, each of them would tell you that when we came back to the U.S. and they went to public schools in California, that they got far less attention and they were more like numbers. And I mean, I tell this story in my book where, and it's actually, I start the book with this. The first week of school, I got a phone call, a text, and an email at the same time at 9 p.m. every evening saying my kids were absent for multiple nights in a row. And it's because they didn't even know my kid. And, you know, initially I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, my kids cut school, you know, and I'm like staring at them. But no, it's just they got it wrong. And you know, we're looking at schools where there's literally, if there's even a counselor in the school, the ratio is like 350 or 450, sometimes 500 students to one counselor.
Oh, yeah.
And most of the time, if you're getting attention outside of the classroom, it's because you've gotten into trouble, and we're talking serious disciplinary trouble. So even in the classroom, and you know, and I want to make this clear too, I will never fault a teacher because we don't support our teachers in this country. They don't get the right training. They don't get the right retention in terms of the pay, the cost of living, and we certainly don't invest in their professional development. So it's almost like, you know, they become martyrs here, and they become the scapegoats too. So we have to do a much better job of investing in our teacher recruitment, retention, and professional development.
All right. So if you were going to put some steps together on what the United States could do better, would that be step one?
Oh, that would be a tie for number one, because I mean, I say, and I say this all the time, if you have a great teacher, it doesn't matter what your physical plant is like. It doesn't matter how many students. I mean, you can't have one teacher to 1,000 students. But, you know, if you have a qualified teacher, we're talking someone who's gotten not only the theoretical pedagogical training in school, but, you know, understands child development, knows how to interact with teachers, has mentoring or a mentor when they first get into the classroom so that they, you know, how often do you hear their first year teacher is miserable? Mm-hmm. It happens all the time, and we lose them. We lose them after year one, definitely by year five. So we have to do so much more for our teachers. But I will say the other thing is equity, right? This country, the federal government on average only pays or supports 10% in terms of funding for our public schools. And the rest is divided between your tax, your district, and your state. And if you live in an area with low property values and therefore low taxes, your schools are not going to be funded at the same rate as if you live in a high tax area. Mm. And it's up to the states to, you know, to stem that disparity. And it doesn't happen. So what we have right now is in these international test scores just came out last week. What we see, the kids who are most socioeconomically disadvantaged have the lowest growth mindset, and they're performing at the lowest levels. And the kids who are economically advantaged are performing at the highest levels. Mm. And that gap is only becoming worse and worse. So if we don't, you know, democracy only works if we educate everybody who can vote, mm. right? And we have to give everybody an opportunity to be educated. So we're just not doing a good job.
Yeah. Sometimes I find too that you learn some things as a parent and you think to yourself, I never would have thought to ask that. I never would have thought to do that with my kid. I never would have. There's so many things you can do as a parent that you sometimes mm-hmm. don't learn about. Oh, I didn't know I could do that. So what kind of education should we give parents here in the United States in order to be more into their kids' education?
That might be the best question I've been asked, actually, since my book came out.
Oh.
I love that question. And you phrased it exactly right, because they're really small and easy things that you can do as a parent. And so I'm, you know, I get asked by parents, well, how am I supposed to take care of my kid's education if I'm taking him to club soccer 5 times a week, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's, you just answered your own question, right? If you're investing that much time, money, whatever it is in your kid's soccer, you're giving them the message that that's really important. How much time are you spending talking to them about their education? Right.
Hmm.
So this is the number one thing I say. Have these conversations during drive time, during your meals. Make it a requirement. Prioritize what you think is an education. Talk to your kids about it. Is it socialization? Is it math? Is it a certain score? Is it art? What is an education? And talk about it as a regular part of your family, you know, your family interactions. How many books do you have?
Hmm.
You know, are you aware of whether or not your child's third grade teacher is making your children memorize the multiplication tables? Because if not, you got to do it at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to have these values entrenched, and you have to have high expectations.
Wow.
So these are the things that you have to talk about with your kids. It's like, you know, so many kids these days, especially in the U.S. with grade inflation, it's really easy for them to get a good grade. Right. And sometimes it's all about compliance. It's because they're good kids. They show up. Maybe they contribute to the class. Maybe they're organized. But how much content are they actually responsible for?
That's interesting.
Right? They could go from year to year and not actually know that much, not having read that much. So as a family, that's something that you can gauge just on conversation at the table. So I would say do that on a daily basis, because as much as we're told that kids shouldn't get, you know, positive reinforcement because from their parents, because they're just going to do it for their parents. The reality is we all want to be validated by someone. And if you're showing your kids that, you know, club soccer is what you're spending your time on, guess what they're going to be? They're going to be really good at soccer, right? But they may not be that good at school if you're not talking about it that much.
I know what you mean. Well, how old are your kids now?
So I have a high schooler, middle schooler, and an elementary schooler. So I have a 15, a 14, and a 10.
Oh, that's great. That really is amazing. I'm guessing they impress every teacher they're put in front of.
In more ways than one. I do have two teenagers.
All right. So if people wanted to check out your book, it's called World Class, One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children. Where can they find it?
You can find it on Amazon, Target, Barnes & Noble. It's been a bestseller on Amazon, I'm very proud to say.
Ooh.
So, yeah, it makes a great gift for parents and teachers, I believe. I've been told repeatedly it's a really fun book. Because, you know, I tell personal anecdotes, too, that hopefully make people laugh.
Okay.
You can find me on my website, TarukLavelle.com, and I'm on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. So reach out to me, follow me, whatever you like. But, you know, these are conversations that we just all have to be having all the time, because I feel like here I'll give you a little interesting factoid, which is our kids think that school is more competitive than any other country.
Huh.
Can you imagine? And we think that we're so collaborative, right? Our kids perceive it as being the most competitive.
Interesting.
And yeah, and so what I say to that is maybe we model that as parents. So let's please, as parents, try to cooperate and help one another and teach one another and be out for another, you know, and be there for one another instead of, you know, calling the police when your neighbor leaves their 13 and 15 year old at home on their own. You know, maybe say the opposite. Like, hey, why don't you come over for dinner?
Yeah, you know? I see what you're saying. You know, that spirit. The competitive spirit, yeah. That's something you find all across the United States. All right, so people can look you up online. The book, World Class, on Amazon, One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children. And author Tarouk Lavelle, had a great time talking to you. Thank you for coming on to Overnight America.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Real, real fascinating stuff from Tarouk. Joins us on the Quiver River Electric KMOX guest line. In the newsroom, Megan Lynch, she's going to join us next talking about her series on urgent care across St. Louis. That's coming up on Overnight America.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
Overnight America continues. Oh, this night is just flying right by. Joining us now from the KMOX newsroom, Megan Lynch, thank you for coming on live with us here tonight.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
You know, you're doing the Urgent Care series this week on KMOX. You've done some excellent, excellent work there. And I think a lot of people are interested in finding out just really what you've discovered when you go and look at some of the differences. There's not like a universal anything when it comes to urgent cares across St. Louis. Where did you even come up with this idea to investigate it to begin with?
Well, I guess because of what I was seeing in my own area, I'm on the Illinois side of the river, and it seemed like I was seeing urgent care after urgent care either being built or being opened, maybe, you know, in an outlot of a shopping center or, you know, maybe a mile or two from one of the big hospitals we have over here. So it started with that kind of, I guess, curiosity about why did we need all of these urgent care centers?
And I see them pop up. It's, you know, they make a big deal when these urgent cares pop up. There's so many of them around here, too. And it's interesting to see the differences between them. That's part of your series. So what different topics of the series have you covered so far?
We're looking at, number one, just the variety. There really is no standard. What we have been told by insiders and experts is that urgent cares are not created equal. They can be very different in the services they provide. Also, you know, there's some question about how much they should or should not be regulated, and really, do you know how much oversight is at that facility when you go there? Also, the issue of insurance, and are people being pushed to urgent care by the fact that there are insurance company policies that really make it less expensive to go to urgent care? So all those kind of factors about, you know, basically just being a consumer for yourself when it comes to which urgent care you're going to choose, what's best for you, and really what you're going to spend when you go there.
So what did you find on the regulation side that surprised you? Because you said that there isn't a universal sort of set of rules when it comes to how they operate.
That's right. It's very interesting because basically if they are, for example, a nonprofit or an independently owned urgent care, if they're not affiliated with a hospital, then their oversight is very similar to that of a physician's office. So it's not like the facility itself has some set of guidelines they have to follow. Now, having said that, I don't want anyone to think that they're completely unregulated, because what you have is you have the professionals that work in there that are subject to the standards, for example, of a professional board. or maybe, for example, the facility has to follow certain guidelines when it comes to medicines with the DEA, or if they have x-ray equipment, obviously they'd have to comply with what radiology boards would tell them to do. But unlike a hospital, where a hospital-owned system might have kind of a higher level of certification where they have to show that the people that they have in place have certain competencies. That's a term that they use to show that they're qualified to do certain things. You know, they have to have certain staffing in place. They have to be able to handle certain things that walk through the door, you know, in a hospital setting. That's not necessarily the case in an urgent care. It all kind of depends on who's running it.
You know, Megan Lynch joining us here out of the KMOX newsroom in this week. Her series on urgent care is airing in the morning and also the afternoon. And you're on Twitter, at M. Lynch on Air. That's your Twitter handle. And you've been doing these certain polls, and you're putting some questions up for the people that may be listening or following you on Twitter. Someone could go on and answer some of these questions on the poll. What I like that you do is that you ask these questions to get the impressions. You want to know what impressions people have before they hear your investigative piece. You want to know really what their understanding is, because you're also curious about how that impression in their mind changes after they learn certain things.
Well, that's right. You know, and part of it too is what I've found in doing this is that this is really a consumer-driven area of medicine that we have right now. I think it'll be really fascinating to watch, Ryan, how this develops over maybe the next 5 to 10 years, because I think, you know, maybe 10 years ago, a lot of people were really skeptical about what urgent care medicine could be. But now what a lot of doctors have kind of stepped back and looked at, and even some of the other practitioners, is that this is what people are asking for. And the top thing that people told me, the top reason why they want to go to urgent care, it's not necessarily the cost. That was pretty low on the list when I did the poll on Twitter. The top thing they told me was convenience. It's about being able to get in, get out, find someplace close, not have to make an appointment. Things that a lot of the urgent care insiders told me they heard from their patients. You know, another factor for people, I think, is who are they going to see when they walk in the door? Not all urgent cares have a physician on duty 24/7. Now, they might have someone who's their medical director who oversees their training and their protocols and all of that, but they might not necessarily be in the building when you walk in. Now, that's not to say that nurse practitioners and physician's assistants aren't highly qualified, but I was just curious to see what the experience was for people. And more people said on their last visit to urgent care that they saw a nurse practitioner. That was 43% of the people that responded to our poll. That was followed by 26% said they saw a physician. The 19% said they saw a physician assistant.
You know, the services they offer are vary too, depending on where you go. And you really, can you even tell before you walk into a building what kind of services they offer? Or you just know you need something done, and then you eventually say, okay, this one's close to my house, let's go see what they can do.
Yeah, which really is, if you have something serious going on and you may not realize it, some people think that's really rolling the dice in a way, because some of them, maybe they are really able to handle a lot of emergency cases. Maybe they've got a lot of skilled physicians on staff who have emergency department experience, which that's not uncommon. But what if you end up going to one where really their main mission is to take care of really routine stuff? They maybe do some sutures, some strep tests, you know, help you if you have the flu. If you have something serious go on and you walk in one of those, you know, people ask, is there the risk, you know, of not being properly diagnosed?
Interesting. I hear those stories of people walking into an ER thinking that, like, you know, the one story that was popular in the last couple of weeks was a guy gets scratched by a random cat and thinking, because it broke blood, that that cat might have rabies. So walks into a ER because the urgent care, I think, said, yo, you got to go to the ER for something like this. And just the fact that he sat down, even though he didn't actually get any rabies shots, because those can be over $10,000, he was given a bill of, what, $2,000, $2,500 just for the fact to talk to a doctor at an ER. So I'm surprised when you say that it's convenience over cost. To me, I feel like if I'm going to do anything, man, urgent care all the way, it's going to cost me tenfold less to walk into one of those places to get anything compared to what would be like an ER situation.
Well, and what's really interesting is there's a lot of people that say that, that yes, anecdotally, they know that the costs of emergency room care have risen. Now, some people will argue, well, yes, that's because you have all those experts on staff. It's because you have the facility there that has all of those diagnostic tests. But a lot of that isn't factored into the cost of how the costs have risen. There are some interesting studies by the Healthcare Cost Institute that have looked at that. Unfortunately, when I talk to them, at this point, we don't really know what the true costs of going to urgent care are.
Hmm.
You know, you can hear anecdotally what those are, and the practitioners will tell you, yes, they can provide some of those tests for significantly less than they do in the hospital. But really, there's been no comprehensive study, because a lot of times these are lumped in with maybe a physician's office visit instead of being specifically an urgent care visit. And, you know, how do you factor in, let's say you go to an urgent care and then you need to do a follow-up? Should that be included in those costs? What if you get sent to the emergency room? Do you have double costs? I don't know. So that's for statisticians to look at, I guess.
Yeah. You know, Megan Lynch joining us here from the KMOX Newsroom in her series this week. You can check out about urgent care. It's a must listen to here on KMOX News. So when you walk into a restaurant, you see a grade in the window, you know, an A grade or whatever, and you look at that and you say, oh, okay, good. They're on the up and up when it comes to regulation. Here in the United States, and even when it comes to our own medical care, there is very little personal oversight that we have. Like, we're just going to walk into this place and we're going to trust that they're all good. Everything's up to code. Because honestly, you can slap urgent care on a building. How many people actually research if there's anything that's ever been a problem in that building or the doctors beforehand? It feels like we do so little research ahead of time. It really surprises me that how much trust we put in a stranger's hands without actually looking into it.
It might be really hard to do. You know, and what you might have to do is look at consumer satisfaction surveys. You know, and what's hard is, so if we're looking at the fact that a lot of these are looked at like a private doctor's office, you would have to go to a professional board and try to search for each one of the individuals that work there
mm-hmm.
to find out if they've had any complaints. You might have to look up records in court to see if there have been any malpractice claims against these individuals. I mean, so it could really be difficult if you wanted to really dig deep and see you know, what the folks were like that were staffing it, you know, what their history was.
Yeah. Well, the series continues. Is Thursday the conclusion of the series?
Friday is the conclusion.
Friday's the conclusion. How long have you been working on this?
For weeks and months.
Yeah, you've done a great job with it. Excellent job with it.
You know, and the thing is, and I'm sure you feel this way too sometimes, I could have gone even deeper. But we really just want to kind of present, you know, the first part of this is just information for people to help them navigate the system, know what to look for. You know, each person, I think, probably has a different perspective on what they want out of an urgent care. So maybe this will help folks to find the one that's the best fit for them.
Yeah, I think that'll help. Just learning about it, that's a big part of it. Sometimes you need to have that type of cue to give you that little nudge to say, maybe I should be doing these sort of things. I think you're giving a lot of people a nudge because this is an afterthought, even though it shouldn't be. You're talking about medical care. It shouldn't be an afterthought. You know, you should take a little precaution ahead of time. You should know what you're doing, and you should probably get a little more insight into it, which is exactly why series like these are very important. So again, on Twitter, at M Lynch on air, people can go vote in your poll and you can kind of see where the public stands on some of these different issues. They can look you up on Twitter that way. Thank you for coming on to Overnight America.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's Megan Lynch from our KMOX newsroom joining us on the Quiver River Electric KMOX guest line on Overnight America.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
Just a real quick question to producer Mike. Any job you've ever worked in your life, have you ever received a holiday bonus?
No.
No. I don't think I have either. I can't think of one. Like, one time I worked at a radio station around Christmas time, they would give you a logoed item. Like, here you go. Here's your staff shirt for the year.
Here's what we're trying to get rid of.
Oh, no, no. Hey, congratulations. We're going to give you a logoed tote bag, station logo on it. And you're like, thanks. That's really nice. Like, the station I worked for, just before I got here in Fort Wayne was like that. They's like, here is a laptop bag with the, because you can put your company laptop in there. They gave to the program directors. Here you go. Like, oh, that's our Christmas gift, something you should have given to us with the company equipment to begin with. You know, it was like little things like that. Nothing of ever any value or something that you would look at and say, oh, that's really nice. Which leads me to the story that everyone's talking about, the jealousy people have for this Maryland company. A real estate company in Maryland offered a big gift to all of its employees. There's 198 employees. It's St. John Properties. This real estate company shared a bonus with all of their employees, and divvied up between those 198 was $10 million. So employees received about $50,000 apiece, $50,000 bonus. Says, to celebrate the achievement of our goal, we wanted to reward our employees in a big way that would make a significant impact on their lives, said Edward St. John, the company's founder and chairman, said in the statement. This is the type of thing I want to, you know, when people send those company emails out and then they accidentally hit reply all, and then like you, they're like, okay, you really shouldn't have hit reply all in a situation like this. Like, you bothered the whole company for it. I want to hit a reply all and send this link to someone. It's like an accidental, like, oh, I can't believe I meant to only send this to one person. But hint, hint, how about we do this, what the company in Maryland's doing to where we work, too? I'm not saying, like, specifically here to KMOX, but in general, if you work for a company, don't you want to encourage the people you work for to say, hey, get on board. Let's be the next one to make national news for treating your employees really nice. Wouldn't that be great? People say it's life-changing. Yeah, no kidding. $50,000. Remember when Oprah Winfrey gave a free car to the entire studio and everyone went absolutely crazy? And you get a car! And you get a car! And everybody gets a car! And she's going nuts. And people, these women's heads are exploding inside of the studio audience. And rightfully so. And then they are faced with the realization that they may have received like a, you know, $25,000 gift right there, but then they got to pay taxes on it. Well, same thing's going to happen with all these bonuses. It's not like you're going to get $50,000 tax-free. Now, hopefully they're smart enough to realize this sort of thing, but still, it's a lot easier to hand over cash and pay the taxes on it than anything else. How amazing is that, really? Honestly, how amazing is that? What if there were some unintended consequences? I'm just going to play devil's advocate here. What if of those 198 employees, there were some part-time people that had some sort of government assistance because they only worked limited hours? Sure, they love that sort of thing, but now Uncle Sam's going to come to them and say, you need to make up for all the other things you've been getting for free now this year, now that you've reached this threshold. Nah, that's probably not going to happen. Government would never try to mess with people, ever, ever, ever. But, you know, all kidding aside, I want to say this is one of the coolest stories that you could cover. It's so cool to see something like this. So you should give a big bravo to companies that do something nice for their employees around Christmas time with bonuses like this. It really is a neat thing. Doesn't it put all other companies at check? What are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? This is Overnight America. And our friend Tom Sullivan is going to come up right after the top of the hour news on KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.